From Illinois to Utah, Hawaii to Alaska, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, dock workers are on strike, shutting down ports up and down the East Coast. Sean Higgins from the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here to discuss the impact. The one and only 2024 vice presidential debate is now history. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with a real story on how well the candidates perform. The federally administrated organ donation program is failing to efficiently get donated organs to needed recipients. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details. And the enduring mystery of where Amelia Earhart and her ill-fated airplane are located may be close to being solved. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The International Association of Longshoremen have commenced a strike that has idled ports from Maine to Florida. Sean Higgins joins us now to discuss the impact. He is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Sean, the dock worker strike, the International Longshoremen's Association, their walkout. Talk a bit about the economic impact. Will there be a short-term impact on consumers, on the economy? And if this goes on for any number of weeks, what would that impact look like?
In the short term, we may not have much of an impact. There's plenty of stuff that's still in the pipeline, so to speak, being shipped out to retailers, grocery stores, although there are some reports of people going out and panic buying in the grocery stores, so we're likely to see a bit of shortages that way. In terms of the overall impact, it's going to cost the economy about $5 billion a day. That's the estimate from, I believe, Goldman Sachs. You know, the longer it goes on, obviously, the more stuff is going to stack up at the ports, and we're just going to start seeing backups all down the supply chain. So you're going to start to see shortages. You're just going to start to see prices climb up. They're going to try and deal with it to the extent that they can by rerouting a lot of the shipping to the West Coast ports, which is what they did when we had the supply chain crisis in 2021, because that was mostly ships being idled in the West Coast ports, and they rerouted them back to the East. Some of those apparently have never really rerouted back to the West after the COVID crisis ended, but they can't do that, so they'll move it that way. You know, we're going to start to see some prices go up, and we're going to start to see shelves get bare, but maybe not in the next week or so.
The Biden administration, of course, is concerned about this, and they have some various levers that they can pull here, including something called the Taft-Hartley Act, but they seem to be reluctant to do that. Would you explain what the Taft-Hartley Act would allow them to do and talk about their response?
The Taft-Hartley Act refers to some of the amendments in 1947 to the National Labor Relations Act, which is the main law that covers union activity in the U.S. It gives the White House the power in situations of national emergency to essentially force a deal in the contract negotiations, essentially to write up their own contract as if they're arbiters, to basically require the sides to do that if they feel it's hurting the overall economy and safety of the nation. The Biden administration does not want to do that. They did it in 2022 with a threatened railway worker strike. And they got a lot of pushback from organized labor for that because they felt the feeling was that they acted prematurely out of a fear of the economy being damaged, so they don't want to see that happen again. And they don't want to offend organized labor in the lead-up to the fall election. At the same time, if the economy does get bad, if prices start to spike and shelves start to get empty, the sitting administration is the one that's going to take the heat for that. So they're trying to sort of resolve this peacefully now if they can, but there is some push from trade associations to get them to bring the hammer down and end the strike if they can. They're going to hold off for the time being, but they might do that later on if they feel pressured into doing it.
A bit of being between a rock and a hard place here politically for the administration. And if we look at the actual issues that are at play here in the negotiations that have triggered this strike, Sean, one of the main concerns of the union seems to be the impact of automation and whether or not it would cost union jobs, but it's also a matter of efficiency. So could you talk a bit about automation and the role it is playing in this strike?
American ports are actually well behind international standard in terms of automation. and just replacing jobs with robots, cranes, mechanized equipment, and the like. The World Bank puts out ratings of international ports in terms of efficiency, and there isn't a single U.S. one that's in the top 50, believe it or not. And the closest ones are, I believe, Philadelphia and Charleston. The reason for that is simply because we have strong unions in the U.S., and they fought tooth and nail against any form of automation, which they see as an existential threat to their jobs. You know, the ports have attempted to automate, have been pushed back on it, and that's one of the major issues at play in this contract negotiation. And dock workers make pretty good money. The average is about $150,000 a year. They've been pushing for a 77% pay increase. The dock ports have offered 50%. But the real issue that seems to be holding it up is that the union wants no automation at all at the ports. And the ports are saying, that's not tenable. We need to get these things up to closer to the international standard. And that's, as far from what I can tell, is really the real underlying issue here. I mean, money is always something that can be negotiated and worked out. They'll usually accept something in between what both sides want. But in terms of automation, that's a much different issue. And their push for no automation at all is just going to, is not something that the industry can really accept. And they're going to try and push back against. So we're going to see something stretch out for a while as a consequence.
As you referenced, this strike is affecting ports on the East Coast, not the West Coast. In terms of contract negotiations, is this the first time that this whole issue of automation has become the key sticking point in a negotiation, or have we seen that in ports on the West Coast and elsewhere?
It's been an issue in all of them. I mean, it was one of the issues in the West when we had the supply chain crisis on the West Coast in 2021. One of the reasons why we're seeing it now is because there was a sort of deal that was pushed. Administration didn't exactly invoke Taft-Hartley, but they did step in and help negotiate one. And they negotiated a deal with more pay, but not much in the way of guarantees regarding automation. And the East Coast ports looked at that and said, we don't agree with that at all. So part of the reason why they're putting their foot down this time around is because they're afraid that history will repeat itself if they don't make a stand on this issue. So it's always been an issue, but it's bubbling closer to the surface now because of the more recent supply chain issues and strikes that we've had.
We have been talking with Sean Higgins. Sean is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, tell us a little bit about CEI. Also, you have written on this topic and many others. Where can folks go to find those writings?
CEI is the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We are a nonprofit free market think tank. We believe in free minds and free markets and the belief that individual workers need to be empowered to be able to sell their labor on an open marketplace. You can find us at CEI.org and find my stuff there as well.
Sean Higgins of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Sean, thank you for being back with us. Appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth, so he is keeping an eye on things in Congress and also politically. A lot of news, major news developments this past week. We're going to talk about them with Scott Parkinson. Scott, as always, good to have you here.
Thanks for welcoming me back.
The one and only vice presidential debate took place this past week, and vice presidential debates usually don't move the needle a lot, but it appears that J.D. Vance did an amazing job and helped the ticket in many ways. Want to give us your opinion?
I think this is the first opportunity for a lot of people to see the direct contrast between Tim Walz, the governor of Minnesota, and J.D. Vance, the senator from Ohio. You know, everybody that is pretty politically wrapped up in things probably tuned into the DNC convention and the RNC's convention. But when you have a debate, it also gets a lot of new voters that don't want to get bored by just a bunch of speeches, but actually hear questions and answers to policy. And that was one of the big differences with this debate. Was there were a lot of policy answers. That focus was there. I think J.D. Vance did a good job of articulating his background in Appalachia and why he wrote Hillbilly Elegy and why he joined the Marine Corps and just his personal story. And for a long time in politics, everybody has these low approval ratings and they're kind of made out to be the boogeyman and all this negative coverage on people and their votes or their history or what, you know, anything that they've done. But a survey after the vice presidential debate showed that both Tim Walz and J.D. Vance improved upon their image, meaning their approval rating, what people think of them. And that's a positive thing, I think, for both sides of the ticket. Obviously, on the day of the debate, There was some controversy related to Tim Walz saying that he was in Hong Kong when Tiananmen Square happened, and ultimately his hometown paper in Nebraska revealed that he was still stateside and hadn't yet traveled to Asia. So the truthfulness, the exaggeration on his military record, all the different things that Tim Walz has in his background still needs to come to light, and I think people are learning about that. You know, this week, Jake Tapper from CNN was talking about the debate, and he said, well, you know, J.D. Vance has so much more experience debating, and, you know, he's a senator. Well, Tim Walz is a career politician, right? He's been in office for, I think, about 30 years and served as a member of the House of Representatives, served as governor of Minnesota. So it's not like he's brand new to the scene and having to give a speech, but obviously he was pretty wound up and admittedly very nervous headed into the VP debate. To me, it's an exciting thing because J.D. Vance casts the vision for what America First looks like in a post-Trump world. And I think that actually brings more disconnected and forgotten voters from the Rust Belt and these key swing states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania over to the Trump side than any sort of a vision that I don't find compelling that the Democrats are laying out when it comes to things like reproductive rights and codifying Roe.
In the meantime, in addition to the debate, as I mentioned at the outset here, Scott, we had a very busy news week. Of course, we have large parts of the South suffering the aftermath of the hurricane. We have really an all-out war starting in the Mideast. I want to talk a bit about how these major developments are going to impact the presidential campaign.
Well, obviously, while this interview is broadcasting, we got the one-year anniversary of the October 7th attacks that Hamas laid upon the people of Israel, just a terrible terrorist attack. And this last week, Iran sent hundreds of missiles toward the Iron Dome. I think a lot of them were shot down. Obviously, the Israelis can sort of determine where the trajectory is headed, whether it's toward a rural area that's going to land in the desert or if it's going to land in a populated area, and they shoot those down for the most part. You know, more than anything, it was an escalation following the perceived attacks. I think some of them have been taken credit for by Israel when it came to taking out the leader of Hezbollah and the pagers and the cell phones and all the stuff that's going on there. But simultaneously with the terrible hurricane and the flooding that we've seen in the Southeast, all throughout America, just the stories that are continuing to be revealed now that people are coming back online, the desperation that a lot of communities are still feeling, not just from flooding, but from mudslides. Now, this is a very mountainous area, and especially when you think about Georgia and North Carolina, communities been totally wiped out. I was talking to a member of Congress earlier this week in Florida, and Ana Paulina Luna's district had, I think, 11 deaths and 55,000 people displaced. Terrible situation all across America. You know, I think that you're going to see Congress come back at some point and do a supplemental appropriations to sort of cover the shortfall, because Alejandro Mayorkas, Secretary of Homeland Security, admitted this week that FEMA just doesn't have the funds to deal with the hurricane season. There is some funding in place right now to help in the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Helene. But the problem is that this administration has prioritized equity at FEMA instead of emergency disaster response, and they have sent a lot of money into the illegal alien population that has flooded our country and ultimately depleted FEMA's budget.
As you look then at all these problems that have occurred, throw in also the longshoremen strike as well here, Scott, will this have an impact on the election? We have only about 4 weeks left to go.
The answer is absolutely right. And the question is, what type of an impact, what level, how severe will this impact the electoral outcome? It's very difficult to look into that crystal ball and tell us what's going to happen on November 5th. But there's always October surprises. And in political science, there's a group known as nature of the time voters, right? So whatever the big events are happening in October can sway their vote. Obviously, you have strong ideologues that are going to vote based on Republican conservative principles. And on the other side of the coin, the Democrats that vote with progressives. But you do have people that want to feel things out and hold on till the end. And when you have close elections in America, whether it's a couple of bellwether counties in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania or think about Florida in the year 2000, or just what's happened in Nevada and Arizona with their elections recently. We know this is going to be a close race. People need to get out there and do early voting, bank your vote, make sure you're dragging other friends to the poll.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We're going to continue tracking all of this over the next month with him. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. Our membership, it boasts 525,000 members, united in this idea of economic freedom, opportunity, and liberty. If you want to learn more, visit us at clubforgrowth.org. You can sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, again, thank you for being here.
You are welcome.
As with many aspects of the federal government, administration of organ donations is not being handled efficiently. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains why.
There are more than 100,000 Americans on waiting lists to receive organ transplants, and many of them will die without ever getting one. At least some of those lives could be saved, and many others could be improved if the government monopoly contractors that manage America's organ donation system weren't so bad at their jobs. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. As you may know, in addition to my work on this show, I also produce a podcast for Reason Magazine. The second season of that podcast is out now. A few weeks ago, we played you a clip from the first episode of that season, and now I'm going to play you a clip from what I think is my favorite episode of this season. I think maybe the most important one that we've done. It's an episode about how we could fix some of the problems with America's organ donation system, which is an undercovered, underappreciated problem that really does hurt lots of people every day. Here's a short segment from that episode. You can find the rest of it at Reason.com or look for Why We Can't Have Nice Things on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your pods. I hope you'll enjoy it. As someone who more than occasionally forgets things, I'm all too familiar with the expression that you'd lose your head if it weren't attached to your shoulders. Yes, it's an amusing mental image, but surely someone couldn't actually misplace a vital bodily organ. And if your job was to make sure that a donated kidney got to a recipient on time, I mean, you couldn't possibly just leave it, like, sitting at the Atlanta airport for hours on end. Right?
The kidney is supposed to make a connecting flight in Atlanta.
And I just remember the phone ringing, and I answered it, and she said the kidney did not get on the flight.
Are you kidding me? Look, I know everybody makes mistakes, and I also know that being able to take an organ out of one body and put it into another body is a miracle of modern science. But all too often, organs that could have been donated, organs that were intended to be donated, that could have saved someone's life, those organs never make it where they're supposed to go. And the ones that get lost in transit, like that kidney in the Atlanta airport, that's actually a small percentage of the problem. When that happens, sometimes it makes the news. But what you'll never hear about, what I'd never heard about until I started working on this podcast, are the thousands of organs that could have been donated every year, but simply don't get collected. That's a huge failure in terms of lives and money.
It's hurting patients, it's hurting the taxpayers, and we've got to get to some real accountability.
I'm Eric Boehm, and you're listening to my Reason Magazine podcast series about how the government's involvement in healthcare is making us sicker and poorer, and about how free markets and more freedom can cure that. In today's episode, I'm exploring how the federally funded and controlled organ donation system is failing patients who desperately need transplants, and what we could do to fix it. This is Why We Can't Have Nice Things. So if you're like me, about the only time you think about organ donation is when you go to renew your driver's license and you see that little box that asks whether you want to be added to the National Registry. Most people check it. The battle of hearts and minds has been won, at least when it comes to the question of donating hearts and, well, kidneys, livers, and so on.
95% of Americans support organ donation. It literally pulls higher than puppies and ice cream, we checked. So Americans are doing their part. They are generous. But it turns out that literally tens of thousands of organs that Americans want to donate are not making it to their intended recipients every year.
This is Jennifer Erickson.
And I'm a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists.
Jennifer points out that getting people to sign up to be organ donors is really the easy part. It's a little uncomfortable to think about the rest of the process because in most cases, we'll only encounter it when a loved one has died. But understanding how the donation process plays out is actually essential to understanding what's broken. Okay, so I'm dead, and the government, and I'm an organ donor, that's on my driver's license. The hospital is going to call up who exactly, and what is the next step in that process?
Well, only about 2 or 3% of deaths are from people who are dying in an organ donation eligible way. Because if you think about it, right, something's happened to you, but one or up to eight of your organs are okay. So think about car accidents, overdoses, traumas, strokes, things like that. So what happens is every hospital is assigned to one organ procurement organization, or OPO. That is a government monopoly. So if already you're thinking there's a problem, you're right. It is a government monopoly that is supposed to then turn up at the hospital at every organ donation eligible case every time and have a conversation with the family or the next of kin, or they'll have one of two versions of the conversation. Smith family, I'm so sorry for your loss. John was a registered organ donor. We'd like to go ahead and honor his wishes. Or Smith family, I'm so sorry for your loss. John seemed like a wonderful person. Can we talk to you about organ donation? If that government contractor doesn't show up, his organs, your organs, my organs cannot be recovered. And that's where the problem is.
According to researchers at the University of Pennsylvania and a nonprofit called Organize, get it? Organ eyes. They say that 28,000 donatable organs are going uncollected each year, including 17,000 kidneys. Meanwhile, there are more than 100,000 people on the waiting list to receive an organ transplant. The vast majority of them are waiting for a new kidney, and many will die before they get one.
You're a monopoly. You're not competing with anyone. You can't, they've never lost their contract, so there's has been no federal oversight. There's no financial restrictions. They get paid the same regardless of how many organs they recover. So what we've ended up with is there is literally a 400% difference between the highest performing contractors and the lowest performing contractors. So some of these are doing their job. That's great. They should keep doing it. But how wild is it in a life and death issue that's costing 33 American lives every single day that the taxpayer funds that we'd be funding this kind of deadly failure?
For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Once again, that's a short clip from our Why We Can't Have Nice Things podcast series. You can find the rest of that episode and the rest of the series at Reason.com, on Spotify, and on Apple Podcasts. I hope you'll check it out. And of course, catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The whereabouts of Amelia Earhart's plane crash has been the subject of searches for decades. But the mystery may now be solved, as we learn from editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, Dr. Paul Kengor, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
In the summer of 1937, a nation was in mourning. It had endured a terrible trauma, a national tragedy. In fact, much of the planet was in shock at what had happened. The world's most famed female flyer, Amelia Earhart, had disappeared amid a riveting voyage to become the first woman aviator to circumnavigate the globe. The 39-year-old Atchison, Kansas native already had quite a list of aerial accomplishments. In 1928, she had been the first female pilot to cross the Atlantic. 4 years later, she did the transatlantic flight solo without a stop. And now, taking a giant leap forward, she attempted to become the first female aviator to fly around the world. Still more impressive, this would be a truly full circling. Earhart aimed to circumvent the Earth at the latitude of the equator, i.e. the largest possible circle, and by the way, also the hottest. The heat itself added further danger to the precarious mission. If Earhart's aircraft happened to crash along the equatorial route, the heat could be a lethal threat to any possibilities of survival. In all, Earhart was widely hailed for these feats of daring. She was often referred to as the Lady Lindy, the female equivalent of flyer Charles Lindbergh, albeit renowned in her own right. She was a household name. She's still famous, taught in schools today as a pioneering woman and making appearances in Hollywood movies. Even today in the 2020s, little girls dress like Amelia Earhart for Halloween. And yet she became still more famous in death. What has made her memory especially notable was her utterly mysterious disappearance, which still fascinates. And so, it occurred on July 2, 1937. That morning, Earhart took off from Ley, New Guinea in the Central Pacific in her Lockheed Model 10E Electra plane, along with her trusty navigator, Fred Noonan. They left the Ley airfield at 10 a.m. local time, which would have been 12 a.m. GMT. Their destination was Howell Island, a tiny sliver of land easy to miss. It's only about 6,500 feet long and 1,600 feet wide. Howland was 2,556 miles from the Ley airfield. That's long. That's about the distance from West Coast to the East Coast in America today. The trip would take an estimated 20 hours. Alas, Earhart and Noonan never made it to Howell Island. The conventional wisdom has long been that the plane ran out of fuel and went down somewhere in the Pacific, fatally doomed by a failure to locate Howland. Earhart's body was never found. The plane has never been located, perhaps until now. One man believes he has found the actual plane of Amelia Earhart. His name is Tim Mellon, the philanthropist. He has the photos to prove it. In fact, I wrote at length about Mellon and his findings, including the photos, in a lengthy piece at the American Spectator, which you can check out at www.spectator.org. I encourage you to take a look. Tim Mellon believes that Earhart's plane went down near Nicomaroro, a tiny atoll once known as Gardner Island, one of the Phoenix Islands belonging to the Island Country Republic of Kiribati. Mellon is not alone in this theory. Researcher Rick Gillespie has also followed the Gardner Trail for years. Gillespie and his organization, which is called Tiger, has done over 10 expeditions to the island since 1982 in search of Earhart. If the conclusions of Gillespie and Mellon are accurate, it would mean that Earhart's aircraft did not exhaust its fuel supply searching for Howland Island, and hence crashed and sank in some still undetermined location deep in the Pacific, which many have long believed. Rather, the plane finally has been located just off the coast of Gardner Island. Mellon, in fact, says with confidence, "It's over. Forget about it." To those searching elsewhere for the aircraft, he urges them, quote, "Don't torture yourself anymore. Don't waste another dime on a mission so fraught with impossibility. The visual evidence is compelling," unquote. According to Mellon and Gillespie, Earhart passed Howland Island, went a few hundred miles south, and actually landed on the coast of Gardner Island. At that point, however, unfortunately, the island had no fresh water for her and Noonan to drink from, and the heat was a crazy 110 plus degrees. The two did not survive the elements and perished, probably over a course of weeks, at the island. Mellon, he believes that he's seen the visual evidence underground in the water with pictures of the rudder and other parts of the airplane. Again, they're posted at the article at the American Spectator. Gillespie, he too believes that Earhart made a crash landing at Howland Island. So, I say it's high time that we go back to the island and take a close look. One of history's greatest mysteries, the disappearance of Amelia Earhart, may finally be solved. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KWSH-AM in Shawnee, Oklahoma, WYBB-FM in Charleston, South Carolina, along with WWFA-FM in Florence, Alabama. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.